Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to another episode of Voices for Excellence. I am your host, Dr. Michael Connor, CEO and founder of the Agile Evolutionary Group, and of course, the proud host of VFE. And today's guest is an absolute honor where we had many conversations where the direction of technology and AI is going, specifically about the landmark guideposts. I like to say the landmark report that pretty much every educator is actually using in their hands. And it is great to have, and we're going to go deep into that, but it's absolutely great to have Susan Berrydin, who is the Director of Marketing for Identity Automation, but also the CEO for Berrydin Education Teaching Consulting. But I would like to highlight her landmark work as she's one of the authors for the 2024 National Educational Technology Plan. Now, to my audience, Susan, when somebody like this of this magnitude, I actually have an opportunity to talk to, I am going to unpack and unwrap all of the threads within the report and concepts as well. That's why I was asking you so many questions. And then I said, Susan, I had to get you on my podcast because my audience need to hear this. But again, to my audience, we have one of the authors here that wrote this report for the United States Department of Education. But moreover, I need my audience, and I need your audience to really get this report in your hand because, like I said at the outset, it is a guidepost for your implementation process. So without any further ado, Susan, welcome to Voices for Excellence. How are you? Good morning. It's early. Yes, it is.
I'm doing fabulous. And can I just say it is great to hear. It's great to be here. And my goodness, what a lovely introduction. Thank you so very much.
Absolutely, Susan. And Susan, it is absolutely an honor to have you here. So for my audience, I'm going to ask some rigorous questions. And the reason why I want to ask these rigorous questions is because I want my audience to take your sentiments and I want them to unpack it and segment it into practical strategies that they can employ within their learning organization, within their leadership practices, but moreover, how it can impact instruction for better outcomes for Generation Alpha and Generation Beta. But we're going to start with this first question, Susan, and it is a fun question, okay? And I want to ask you, right? I know everybody knows you're one of the co-authors for the 2024 National Educational Technology Plan, and your current work that you're doing, I want you to unpack that as well with identity automation and also your consulting services. But Susan, what song describes your leadership signature in the education ecosystem?
That's a great question. Well, you know, I'm a child of the 80s, so I'm going to say Journey's Don't Stop Believing.
Wow.
Because...
That is a classic.
Yes. So I really feel that it's important that folks not stop believing in the power of education. And sometimes there are so many headwinds, and it is important, I think, to keep our eye on the ball and remember why we're doing this work. And it is to support kids and to make it possible for them to be successful in lives as contributing members of society. And that is our guiding light. I'm going to talk a lot about the importance of understanding your why today. And so I guess that would be my song for today.
Journey's Don't Stop Believing, Susan. That is, I'm an 80s baby. So yes, that is an all-time classic. You know, those songs that just never get old. So yeah. It came out when you're a baby and you're like, you're older and you're still listening to the songs. And that is one of them. But, you know, Susan, I want to highlight on this, right? And to my audience, this is perfectly contextualized at the time right now, because Susan, both domestically and internationally, but I should say more domestically, I get this implicit notion that, there's this, I like to say, stalemate with believing in education, right? And there's a lot of experiences that are going on. And this is an apolitical response. I'm just generated the qualitative patterns that within the conversations that I'm having nationally. And we have to continue to root our why during this transitional time that we are experiencing domestically in the United States. We cannot stop believing. We can't stop believing in our students. We can't stop believing in our educational systems. And we cannot stop believing in education in totality, because the output is exactly what you stated, is we want to develop and contributing members of our society. Specifically now, when we talk about an uncertain future, the future of education, the future of work, these unprecedented times that we have to prepare our students to thrive in, specifically now having technology and AI, I like to say, as this co-partner with us in this world, because it's becoming this ubiquitous utility in our life, we cannot stop believing. And to my audience, keep pressing, right? Keep pressing, because the work doesn't stop no matter what type of resistance that we are experiencing. But Susan, you have engaged in many national initiatives. Wow, right? I'm a fan of yours. I'm going to admit it. I'm fanboying you, okay? And most recently, you served as the Director of Digital Programs for Innovate, EDU, and facilitated the project for Project Unicorn. I want you to be able to expand on that. But now, as a director of marketing for identity automation and your own consulting services, Bearden Education Teaching Consulting, how has your work continued to challenge the traditional paradigms that are rooted in the education ecosphere?
That's a great question. I would say, for those of you who aren't familiar with identity automation, identity automation offers identity and access management and cybersecurity services to educational institutions, K-12 and higher ed. So our products are designed specifically for education as opposed to being designed for other verticals. And so you might say, well, Susan, how did you go from writing the NETP to becoming the director of product marketing for a identity and access management company? That seems kind of like an interesting pivot. But at its core, it's really about, for me, one of the things I want to talk about a lot today are the importance of foundations, is making sure that you not only have your why as your foundation for using technology, but also make sure that you are implementing technology thoughtfully and intentionally, and in a way that keeps students secure. So, you know, before we know, that's one of the things we say, like, if you look at students when they get their driver's license, we don't just say, hey, you turned 16, you can drive now, have at it. You know, we require students to take a driver's test and demonstrate that they understand the rules of the road and that they know how to navigate safely before we give them a driver's license. And as imperfect as that system may be, it's better than the alternative. And so it's important that when we're using technology that we provide guardrails to keep students safe. And so in order to be able to leverage the power of technology in education, we have to have that foundation, whether that is both security from an IT operations standpoint or security in terms of teaching students about digital health, safety, and citizenship, and making sure they have the skills to navigate the online world safely and securely. So I actually do see a tie between them. I'm a big believer in getting the foundations right before you are implementing technology, and obviously keeping students safe. That's kind of, you know, Maslow's foundation of needs. That's kind of right at the bottom there. So yes, that's how I view my current work.
All right. Yeah. And can you elaborate on your consulting services, Susan? Because I know you have some high profile clients that you're working with transitioning their, whether it be organization, whether it be their practices, implementing components and concepts from the plan that you are working with them directly. Can you unpack that as well?
Sure. You know, I've been in the ed tech space for a long time. And what's kind of unique about my experience is that I'm a former IT director myself. I'm a former teacher as well. And so I have experience kind of on both sides of the ed tech world. So a lot of times people will have expertise in the, you know, the technical aspects of IT operations, which lay the foundation for technology use, or the pedagogical aspects of technology implementation. And so
I have a background in both, which I think is a kind of unique, but also very valuable, because what happens so often in K-12 schools is there are these silos between IT and curriculum and instruction. And how do we make sure that we break down those silos to make sure that teams are working together to support students as opposed to working at cross purposes? So I have done everything from just wrapping up an ed tech audit right now, an IT audit for a school district. I also have done some work helping schools implement the NETP. I have also been working with startups on how to best make sure that they are positioned for success, not just in terms of a business perspective, but also in terms of actually developing a product that is really supporting students. Because at the end, that's my why. That is my driving factor, is how do we make technology use meaningful for student learning? That's full stop. That's what matters. It's all about the kids, and everything else is just noise.
Yeah. Yeah. Susan, thank you for that, because actually, Susan, and you know this, and you're coming in to speak to my cohort this season, spring season, I should say, I'm leading or facilitating the DALI Tech Academy. And one of our sessions focus on how do we create interdependent systems with technology and IT, with curriculum and instruction, facilities, operations, human resources, right? What is that interface? And I like to say the role and responsibility shift in the AC stage of education, where you highlighted some of those traditional silos from the before COVID stage. Now in the after COVID stage, the importance that IT plays with building capacity, building digital literacies within the learning organization as well. But you are absolutely right, Susan. Everything focuses on around student learning, right? Teaching and learning and how we can improve that. But the interfacing, right? The interrelationship between traditional pedagogical approaches or pedagogy and IT. Thank you, Susan, for that, eliminating silos, but providing much more meaningful educational experiences for our students. So now, Susan, this is where I'm going to geek out with you. Okay. And my pen is absolutely ready for this, Susan. But selfishly, this is the reason why I got you on VFB, for me and my audience to learn from you. But I want to spend time now unpacking the 2024 National Educational Technology Plan that you co-authored for the United States Department of Education. Now, going back, I want to go back to its inception, I should say, the design phase of it, right? So in the design phase of the NETP, how were priorities and goals conceived to develop the content of the plan? Second, Susan, from your general observations, work across the country, are we as an education entity advancing the NETP goals in this AC stage of education? And how do we accelerate them if we are not advancing them to this level of vitality that you see?
Okay, I'll start with the first part of your question. So first of all, which was about the genesis of the NETP and how is it developed. And first of all, I want to give a shout out to Zach Chase, who was the co-author of the plan at the U.S. Department of Education. One of my favorite human beings, one of the most brilliant educators I know, and an incredible thought partner. So the first thing I want to let everybody know is that the NETP was not Susan and Zach sitting down in a room and drafting some document about our personal thoughts and opinions on tech. The NETP was put together by a coalition of organizations that was led by CEDA, the State Ed Tech Directors Association. And the organizations involved in the NETP solicited input from about 1,000 stakeholders in the space in developing the NETP. And that information was gathered in many ways. They had focus groups with, I think, just about every stakeholder group that's involved in education that you can imagine, which would improve, teachers, students,
principals, superintendents, tech directors, ed tech coaches, principals, ed tech service providers, folks who are working in research and development. I mean, there were so many people who were interviewed, both individually and in groups, to gather input for what are the challenges that we face in America with regard to the meaningful implementation of educational technology, and what needs to happen in order to address those challenges. So there were parent surveys. We gathered so much information. The team that put this together gathered so much information from so many individuals. And then we had a technical working group, which was a group of individuals that helped us sort through all of this information and figure out what were people saying, what were they identifying as needs, what were the themes that kept coming up. And then we built upon what we heard from the field in developing the National Ed Tech Plan. And some of the, you know, we're going to talk a little bit more about the digital divides. And some of these themes had been mentioned in previous NETP. So the previous National Ed Tech Plan was released in 2017. And it talked about the digital access divide, which has traditionally been defined in terms of providing access to devices and high-speed broadband to students, both in school and at home. And the NETP, the 27th NETP, also discussed the digital use divide, which is the divide between students who have opportunities to use technology in active ways that leverage critical thinking skills versus those students who only have the opportunity to use technology in more passive ways, like drill and kill applications or filling out, digital worksheets that are just, physical worksheets that have been turned into PDFs. You know, those are not active uses of technology, as we'll get into. And then in this plan, what really came through was another divide, which is the digital design divide, which we'll also go into. But that's basically the divide between those educators who are provided the time, space, and personal development in order to build their professional capacity to learn to utilize technology in meaningful ways in the classroom. And so often technology professional development in education is limited to the how to use a tool and not the how to use the tool meaningfully in instruction. There's a difference. Yeah. Both are important, but it's like you have to have both. And so those were the major themes that we heard in our conversations with people. And so that's what we used as the basis of the NETP. So this was really gathered from the thoughts and experiences of educators in the field.
Amazing. Yeah. And Susan, because I'm going to elaborate on that, you highlighted some critical themes in your answer that I want to highlight. But now the extensive data collection that you and the team went through from the themes and patterns that you collected, are you seeing education moving in that direction or that path towards advancing the goals of the NETP report?
Yes and no. I would say that definitely the pandemic brought to light the need for students to have devices and internet access, especially at home, in order to be able to participate in what we refer to as emergency remote learning, because what happened during the pandemic was not high quality online learning. In many cases, it was emergency remote learning because it was something that was done. You know, teachers didn't have a lot of time to plan. There wasn't a lot of professional learning helping educators transition from in-person instruction to online instruction, which of course are very different beasts. They're not the same thing at all. And so definitely there was a flood of technology into schools, into classrooms. But there was not necessarily
because it happened so quickly and on such an emergency basis, there was not necessarily a lot of high quality professional learning or any professional learning, quite honestly, provided to educators on how to use tools. Either one, how to use tools, how to use them, like from a how to navigate this menu perspective, or how to leverage them meaningfully in instructions. So yes and no, there's a lot more technology that's out there. There are a lot of digital tools that suddenly were being used in schools that were not previously being used. But that isn't the same as actually meaning that they were used well. And so I think that actually, in some ways, left a negative taste in a lot of people's mouth about technology because it wasn't high quality use of technology. It was emergency use of technology. So I think there's, in some circles, there's been kind of a backlash against technology. And which I don't necessarily think is unjustified because I'm not a believer in using technology for technology's sake. I mean, you need to have a reason to use it and you need to have a plan to use it well. So the question is, now that we've gotten all of this technology and all of these tools that were often purchased and by schools, you know, without a lot of thought as to the why, because they just needed something in a hurry, how do schools go back now and just take stock of the tools that they're using? How do they evaluate the tools that are in existence and determine which ones they should or should not be using? How do they then go back and take a broader look at the use of technology and say, well, how does this really support what our long-term visions are for student learning, as opposed to just having the technology there because we needed it in this period of emergency remote learning, and now it's still around. So I think now is actually a really important time for people to kind of step back and reflect on how technology has been used in schools and think about how do we use it better?
Susan, great answer, right? And to my audience, this two-part answer, Susan, I always say this in every episode, we use this as a meaningful asynchronous tool of professional learning for adults, for education stakeholders, i.e. andragogy. And to my audience, Susan really unpacked, I counted six different strategies for you to cogitate on with you and your team. But Susan, the design and development of this, I like to say, wow, that was an extensive crowdsourcing activity, right? Crowd-based innovation.
Yes,
where I like to always say the voices from the field, but a former professor I had, Professor Kareem Makani out of Harvard University, he always says the wisdom from the crowd, right? And how you
absolutely
put the qualitative themes and patterns to construct the voices of the educators, of the education ecosystem, and the NATP report is just absolutely fascinating. To my audience, Susan distinctively within her answer clearly part and parcel the difference between professional development and professional learning with technology. There is a distinct difference between the two, professional development and professional learning. And I like to say, Susan, we were leaning on a lot of the professional development, understanding the utility of the tools, as opposed to what was true professional learning that's ongoing for practitioners integrated within their instructional practices. Would be very hard to do it because it was during COVID. And to couple that, Susan, I love the fact that you identify why there's such this, I like to say, resistance and opposition towards technology and AI in education is because we experience the emergency remote learning and instruction versus structured, purposeful online learning and instruction. Two distinct elements, Susan, that we have to be able to characterize. I always go out and say that we can't just say technology is bad because of a previous experience that wasn't so positive, i.e. the emergency remote learning and instruction we had to do during the pandemic. But a high quality use of technology with a purpose and a plan with reflection. Wow, Susan, I'm so glad I got you on, right? Because again, I'm going to actually go back and unpack that and play that and integrate that into my practices. But I want to get down to now the plan itself, the NETP. It's divided or segmented into three core sections: the digital use divide, the digital design divide, and the digital access divide. Now, Susan, just pretty much providing a high-level overview, right? A very broad abstraction for my audience. What are the micro themes of each section that will address the insidious gaps that we see with technology and AI in education?
Okay, well, we started in the NETP with the digital use divide, which is basically the divide between students who have the opportunity to use technology in active ways that leverage critical thinking versus those students who just use technology for more passive activities. And so when we talk about the active use of technology, we're talking about things like things that leverage critical thinking, media production, students using technology to demonstrate their learning in different ways. We're talking about students using technology to design systems. We're talking about students to use technology to make global connections and to collaborate with their peers, or to engage in coding, which is also use of technology that leverages critical thinking, as opposed to students just sitting, like I said, filling out a PDF that was once a worksheet and is now a PDF online, or just using technology to do drill and kill applications, as is often the case. And there's actually been a lot of research that shows that students who come from more disadvantaged home environments are more likely to be limited to using technology in the more drill and kill kind of way, as opposed to having opportunities to leverage higher order thinking skills. And also, it's important to remember that it's a continuum. There's a lot of people think, and I've heard so many stories about this, it just drives me crazy, where people will throw in give teachers a cart of Chromebooks and say, okay, use this technology with your kids, with no instruction on either how to use the tool or how to use it meaningfully in instruction. And that gets to the digital design divide, which is the second divide in the plan, which is providing educators with the time, space, and capacity in order to leverage ed tech meaningfully. So going back to the digital use divide, it's so interesting, because whenever I read stories of like articles online where people are expressing concern about too much screen time or getting technology out of schools, I always read the comments. And what people are complaining about, they're never complaining about the active use of technology.
Right.
What they're complaining about is the passive use of technology, where students are not using technology in ways that leverage their higher order thinking skills. There's a lot of, it's very easy to conflate, students posting content on Snapchat or me watching silly corgi videos on Facebook with actually using technology in ways that help either demonstrate learning or to help students expand their learning. And so I think there's a big education piece that has to happen, one, among administrators to help them understand from a global perspective, from state and district leaders, what that difference is between the active and passive use of technology, and then to educate at the building and classroom level what the difference is between active and passive use of technology. Because, a district can have a one-to-one device program and not be doing anything that's really innovative or is really supporting student learning in unique ways. Or I've seen schools that have not a lot of access to technology, but they're leveraging what they have in really amazing ways. Yeah. So I think that is
I think that's a really big educational piece that has to happen at multiple levels, at really at the system level, is helping folks understand what the difference is and what it looks like, and then helping folks model that behavior for educators, for students, and then providing them with the learning they need in order to change instructional practices.
Yeah, Susan, thank you, because your answer just gave me chills, because essentially, as you know, I designed or created the EdTech solution called the Agile Diagnostic and AI Platform to help learning organizations and systems integrate AI and technology using actual AI and analytics to diagnose the system and have that step function process around continuous improvement and change management for alignment and coherence. But Susan, I really love and appreciate, right, you pretty much identifying what I like to say. We have this high volume of tech, but this low volume of academic and instructional rigor, right? So we have all of these tools, solutions that are out there, but we haven't really seen that synergy to create the equilibrium between the tools and academic rigor for instructional purposes, critical thinking, demonstration of learning with the use of technology. Now, I want to unpack this, right? Active and passive use of technology in building capacity, right? Especially at the systems level, if we want to, like, as an example, disrupt operations for automation and optimization for efficiency. That's one level of technology that we can improve operational systems. Various intelligent systems at the classroom and school level to create coherence, where now we have that equilibrium with that. That's passive and active use of technology. What would be, because this is over time, this is going to take a long time to build.
Yes, it is.
Where do we start with building capacity, and what does that trajectory of learning look like for a system, for instructional leaders, and for our classroom practitioners?
I think first you have to step back and ask yourself, what is your North Star? So in the NETP, it talks a lot about developing for students, like, what is your portrait of a graduate? What are the skills, competencies, and dispositions that you want your students to graduate with? And what should those skills, competencies, and dispositions look like at an age-appropriate level as they develop throughout the K-12 system? And those are never, when you look at those districts who've done a portrait of a graduate, you know, it's really not about learn how to use an Excel spreadsheet. You know, it's usually, it's always about, like, how do you teach students to develop critical thinking skills? How do you teach students to become active community members, to contribute positively to their community, to be flexible, to become lifelong learners? I mean, it varies, but it's always something along those lines. It's never about, when you talk about the portrait of a graduate, it's never about the technology, and it's never about necessarily, I want X number of students scoring this score on a state or national test. You know, it's all about really helping students develop those skills that will make them lifelong learners, because that's the thing. We live in a time when everything is constantly changing. And I think the best way we can prepare students for that is to teach them how to be lifelong learners, because, you know, it's not like back, you know, 50 years ago when people would, you know, start working for a company and then they would be there in that same company, in that same job for the entire length of their career. That's extraordinarily rare now. Now people are shifting jobs, they're shifting careers. Students have to be flexible in order to be able to navigate this new world that we're in. And that includes, you know, being able to adopt and leverage tools like AI, which, you know, 6 years ago was not something that we were talking a lot about in education. All of a sudden, everyone's talking about it in education.
Susan, we were the unicorns. People thought you were crazy 6-7 years ago talking about AI. Now, Susan, 6-7 years later, people are saying, you were saying that a long time ago. Absolutely, Susan.
So it's really about preparing students, for life after they finish high school, you know? And so I think it's important for folks to really think about first, before you start leveraging technology, is to figure out, one, what is your portrait of a graduate? What do you want your students to be able to know and do? And then ask yourself, what is your portrait of an educator? What do you want your educators to be able to know and do in order to be able to teach the students the skills and dispositions that you want them to have as, you know, when they graduate from high school? So first you want to focus on what's your North Star for the students, what you want your students to do. Then you want to focus on what do you want your teachers, what skills and dispositions and do you want your teachers to have in order to be able to build those skills in your students? And then you have to ask yourself, what do the learning environments need to look like in order for teachers to help students develop those skills? And then once you have those three visions in line, I think that's when you can really figure out, okay, how does technology fit into this piece? And it's not all about the technology. You know, people, I remember once I was advising a startup company that actually had content that was not leveraging technology. And they were completely stunned to hear that I was not anti their product. I'm like, yeah, this is great. Yeah, because technology isn't always the right tool for the job. And they were just blown back by that, because technology isn't always the right tool for a job. I mean, there are some times when pen and paper works best, you know. Sometimes when, person-to-person conversations work better than asynchronous or conversations or Zoom calls. It's not either or.
Right.
It's about determining what are your goals and then figuring out how does technology fit into meeting those goals, and then developing the technology systems that you need to make that possible. And that's what the NETP talks a lot about, is about systems. It was really geared towards systems level leaders at the federal, state, and district level.
Yeah.
Because teachers are working in systems and their ability to be successful is often limited by the systems in which they work. So how do we develop systems that make this possible? And as you said, Michael, this is not an overnight process. This does not happen in a year. And so often I've seen educational trends come and go, you know, oh, this is going to, this technology is going to revolutionize education. I remember when it was, Chromebooks that were going to revolutionize education. Now it's AI that's going to revolutionize education, but none of that happens in a vacuum. It's really about recognizing that education is in of itself a very complex system that exists within other complex systems. And
yes,
how do you organize and create systems that set stakeholders up for success?
Susan, that is a textbook. I'm not going to say 101, a textbook 401 at the doctoral level answer. I truly appreciate that, because Susan, when you were talking about the North Star, and the goals, right, the technology goals and the portrait of a graduate, portrait of an educator, you highlighted, I like to say within my 22nd century education model, the portrait of a system, the new structures to be in alignment with these, I like to say, adaptive elements within the portrait of a graduate and the portrait of an educator you highlighted. I don't know specifically, and maybe my audience and you can fact check me, but I believe they're saying that Generation Alpha and Generation Beta, who was just born on January 1st, they're going to go through, I believe, 3 to 5 different careers within their lifetime span. So that's why the 22nd century education model, we want to develop talents of our students, right?
Absolutely.
Deeper than just competencies, but really focusing on talents as well, that where competencies are embedded with it. I really love how you describe the educational system, because you are right. The educational system itself, the density of it is so complex. There's this level of integrated elements and workflows that make up the system, where now our system, I like to say, is characterized as a silo. So we really have to now dismantle these silos within the system, understand the complexities of the subslates within the system, and redesign it and reimagine it, where now the technology goals of a learning organization are realized with that. But what is your North Star? I'm going to start asking people that, Susan. Please tell me what your North Star is with technology so that we can create that equilibrium. But Susan, during my keynote seminars, institutes, I'm starting to really remind people that technology and AI is becoming this ubiquitous utility within our industry. Now, underscored by the themes of the NETP, Susan, what is specifically, in a simplified context, the role of AI, various software solutions, and these emerging technologies in framing the learning experience? And I want to have this as a linear focus, right? Where we're minimizing the scope to Generation Alpha and Generation Beta. And the reason why I say that, after the 25-26 academic year, Generation Z is going to be fully matriculated into the workforce, where now pre-K through 12 is going to be comprised of Generation Alpha. And within the next 3 years, 3 to 4 years, Generation Beta will be entering our PK3 classrooms. So with the focus on Generation Alpha and Generation Beta, how is this going to frame the learning experience for the future?
Well, I think one thing that's important to remember is that I don't see AI ever replacing teachers. And I think anyone who claims that AI is going to replace teachers knows nothing about students and how they learn, because learning is inherently a social process. And can AI be helpful in the learning process? You bet. I'm just going to use, for like my own personal example, I'm rocking my 758-day streak in Duolingo, which is an AI-powered language learning app.
Yeah.
Has it been great? Absolutely. Is it the only thing I need in order to learn French? No, it's not, because I've had to supplement it with, for instance, you know, listening to French podcasts or listening to recordings or actually having conversations with human beings in French, because
human intelligence. I keep referencing that.
Nothing can replace that. And I think it's important, you know, that's just my own personal example for me, because I'm using this particular AI tool. But I think it's important to remember that with any use of AI in education, it's really about, again, start with your why and then determine, okay, well, what can this AI do? And how does that fit into helping us develop that North Star that we're looking at? So if you notice, the NETP does not specifically reference AI. U.S. Office of Education had, the Office of Educational Technology had published some very valuable publications about AI on its own. But if you'll notice in the NETP, we really reference more emerging technologies rather than AI specifically, because there's always going to be some new emerging technology. Today it's AI, tomorrow it will be something else. But I think it's, again, it's important to keep that North Star in mind and then figure out, how can AI be leveraged to help students develop these skills and competencies that they want them to have? And then, again, we talked about the learning how to use the tool versus how to leverage a tool meaningfully instruction. It's kind of the same way. It's like we need to work with students to help them understand how they can leverage AI as part of their learning, but then also how can they leverage AI in other ways as part of their professional career, to save time or, you know, to do things that we haven't even imagined yet. So that's, I kind of see those two different pieces of AI.
So we have to develop that AI literacy for students in terms of how to use AI ethically. And then we also have to look at how does AI-powered education fit into the larger education system. Again, it's part of a system.
Absolutely. Oh, okay. Yes. So, no, I'm sitting here agreeing with you, Susan. I had to pin the head down. I'm into this because, yes. And Susan, a quote, again, I'm going to reference back to Kareem Lakhani. How are you, Kareem? Hope all is well. Kareem stated, and I remember this in class, and I will never forget this. AI won't replace humans, but humans with AI will replace humans without AI. And I thought that was a very provocative statement there, right, for him to state that. But you are absolutely correct. AI won't replace teachers. Teachers are the bedrock, the foundation of education. And I just love how you frame it, where you say teachers are a part of a complex system where we have to be able to, I like to say, unpack the complexities to ensure we reach our North Star. AI ethics is going to be important. That's going to be a continuous conversation because there's always going to be the evolution of AI, even specifically coming down the road, Susan, that you haven't brought up AGI. And what's scary about AGI, Susan, and if you can, to my audience, you know, I don't want to, communicate anything that they might not know. Can you unpack or define what AGI is and why this might be so frightening to individuals in our economy?
So I'm assuming you're talking about generative intelligence, right?
Yes. Artificial. Right. I apologize. You know, we use the soup acronym all the time. AGI. Artificial generative intelligence. Can you unpack what that is?
Sure. And I think you brought up a really good point, is that there are different types of artificial intelligence. So, you know, generative AI is the kind of AI that will allow you to say, well, I'll just give an example of how I used it this morning. I was for part of my job as the director of product marketing, I'm working on a data sheet, and I asked ChatGPT to help draft an introductory paragraph to talk about one of our products and services. And then I took a look at that paragraph, and then I edited it myself. I did not just take what the AI gave me straight, but it provided a helpful scaffolding and framework in order for me to build upon. So, you know, when we talk about generative AI, we're talking about AI like ChatGPT or Notebook LM, you know, Google's Gemini, or other forms of AI like that that are actually generating content, as opposed to, I'm thinking, other forms of AI, which are maybe used in like data and analytics. Okay. You know, you're the AI expert, Michael. So,
Hey, listen, stop the recording. I'm going to use that for my marketing promotion.
Okay. So I think what's happening now in education is that there's so many levels of complexity when it comes to using generative AI, everything from privacy, recognizing that the importance of not uploading, you know, confidential data into generative AI systems because, you know, of the fact of privacy concerns, to is AI going to, and also, I mean, also the fact that AI also reflects, I think, pre-existing biases of the people who programmed it. So that's why, like, if you do a Google search for, you know, attractive woman, you know, you'll see a lot of, you know, stereotypical examples of what AI thinks an attractive woman should be, you know, often, you know, very often white, and not very much skewed from by the data sets that were used to train the AI. Yes. So I think that is a consideration when you're looking at AI. You're looking at concerns about bias. And there's just so many different pieces to it that, especially with generative AI, it's a question of, does that generative AI have the ability to have negative impacts on society? Like, there are stories about how generative AI can sometimes, quote unquote, hallucinate
or actually say things that aren't actually true. And again, that may be based on the data set that it's trained upon. So it's important to look at AI as, I look at it as a very valuable tool, but yeah. it's not the be all end all. It does not replace human critical thinking. And I think that all AI has to be approached with a critical thought process and asking, is this accurate? Is this real? Is it hallucinating? Do I need to fact check what AI is telling me? It is not accurate just because it's generated by artificial intelligence. So I guess that's one of my biggest concerns for generative AI.
Yeah. And Susan, and I appreciate how you brought up the fact that the data sets, right? The data sets within the models that's being tested and trained over time, supervised learning. When you prompt questions like that, you historically see Anglo-Saxon individuals with certain words, prompt words, versus if you put in certain prompt words, you might see Black and brown individuals.
Exactly.
Susan, and again, and I'm not going to extend on this because, again, I'm going to ask you to come back for a part two. I'm letting you know right now is this whole aspect of how do we, and I'm going to bring it up, how do we create digital equity? I'm going to use the word, how do we create digital equity within the models that we're developing? Moreover, Susan, I am with a lot of data scientists. I'm with a lot of software engineers, and I find myself to be the only person of color in there that brings that culturally responsive context to disrupt the testing, training, development of these models and really look at the data to ensure that skewed data, it can be eliminated, or how we can be able to balance that out with the data sets to ensure that there's that level of equity within the actual outputs. The intentionality around the inputs is going to be critical. But Susan, getting on to the next question, right? Because again, you're going to come back, I'm letting you know, because I have another set of series questions or a series of questions that I have to ask. But my corporation, Susan, this is why you have just kind of validated all the work that we're doing within Agile Evolutionary Group, because we're taking a steadfast focus on change management, continuous improvement at the system level, where we're incorporating disruptive technologies and advanced analytics to show for outputs for technology, for innovation, for AI from this context of coherence, organizational coherence. But from a level set lens with the 2024 NETP, what would be these phase processes for educational leaders, stakeholders, board of education members, governance, teachers? How would they be able to take, or how should they be able to take the actual strategies from the NETP and incorporate it into their core operating plan? Because I think about Susan, and when I read the report, I was like, wow, I could have interfaced multiple threads from the actual plan into my strategic operating plan to create coherence, where now schools would have to integrate these threads into their school improvement plans. What does this look like, Susan, from a context of phasing this in to their existing plans?
Well, I would say there are, in the appendices of the NETP, there, in fact, I'm finding them right now as I'm scrolling through the NETP right now. We have guides for state leaders, for district leaders, for school leaders, and for educators on to how to leverage the National EdTech Plan, because that was something that we felt very strongly about, was we did not want the NETP to just be another government document that sat on a shelf. We wanted it to be something that was actionable. And so if you look at the final page, like it starts on page 105, if you're looking at the PDF of the plan, we talk about...
Susan, if I can just interject one second, right? Yeah. Really fast. For my audience, how would they be able to access the NETP on their own? Because you're referencing pages, you're referencing different segments. How would they be able to access this so that if they go back and listen to this episode or this segment, they'll be able to follow along with you?
Well, right now, with the changes in administration in Washington, and there's been a lot of changes at the Department of Education, as you know, right now, the Office of EdTech website is no longer available. However, our colleagues in Europe with the leading EdTech organization in Europe have downloaded and have posted all of the resources from the Office of EdTech's website about educational technology on their website. So it's www.edtecheurope.org/resource -library. And I can also provide you with the link if you want to share it in the show notes. And if you look on that page and just do a search for 2024 National, you'll find the 2024 National EdTech plan there. So I would definitely, I'm very grateful to our colleagues in Europe for making that possible, because again, this is about what's doing what's best for kids. And unfortunately, sometimes with political changes, the focus is not always on what's best for kids, regardless of politics. It's driven by other purposes. So I would highly encourage folks to find the NETP on the EdTech Europe of the EdTech organization's website. And again, that's edtecheurope.org/resource-library.
Thank you. Okay. Now, Susan, back to your answer. Okay. Page 105. I'm glad that you got that out, because again, to my audience, there is, Susan gave me the actual link to the website. There is a plethora of different artifacts that are available for you to reference where we cannot access anymore because of the transition within administration domestically. So thank you for that, Susan. Now back to your answer.
Okay. So there are questions there for different stakeholders on how to best leverage the NETP. So for instance, at the state level, it's asking, does the state providing resources and funding to enable districts to train teachers on the use of the effective use of educational technology? Like, that's something that needs to happen at a systems level. Does the state have a portrait of a graduate or a portrait of a teacher or a portrait of learning environment? Like, does the state have those North Stars? Have they created resources to help districts create their own North Stars? So again, how are they providing resources at the systems level? Because it's all fine and dandy to say, oh, you should be doing this. But if you're not actually providing the funding to make that happen, then it's not going to happen. So that's just an example, like of kind of the, so I'd encourage folks to take a look at these pages based on your role to talk about really about how are you creating the resources that support the systems that will set teachers and students and districts up for success.
Thank you, Susan. And to my audience again, Susan, in the NETP report, when you start unpacking various goals, objectives, strategies within your plan, please reference the appendix section specifically for resources that can be integrated into your system and support your existing strategies, workflows, as well as tenets within your individual plans, even at the site-based level for school improvement plans. And the reason why I asked that question, Susan, because when I was reading the document, reading the NETP, looking at the appendix section, I saw that as these various step functions that I could integrate into my district to create alignment and coherence where variability will be eliminated. I think that this is a really nice constructed plan to help educational leaders at the system level, governance level, state level, even classroom practitioners on closing this digital divide, especially the design divide. But Susan, last question, and you made I don't know if you're a rule follower or not. Most of my guests on VFE are not rule followers. So as I tell every guest that comes on VFE, Susan, take this question as it is. But What three words do you want our audience to leave with regarding transforming teaching and learning in this technological-driven world in the AC stage of education?
I'm going to say,
well, it's four words. Find your North Star.
Find your North Star. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, absolutely. Because, you know, we talked about earlier the importance of identifying your North Star as to guiding your use of technology in the schools. And I feel like that's the most important thing you can do, is you have to figure out what it is that you want your students to be learning, your teachers, the skills you want your teachers to have, what you want learning to environments to look like, and then figure out how to create the systems that will help make that happen.
Find your North Star, Miss.
That's four words. Sorry, but, you know, close enough.
Listen, everybody breaks the rules, man. I have three, you know, times 3,000 with words for this last question. It's okay. Find your North Star. It is the four words. Susan Verdon, thank you so much for coming on VFE. And if my audience wanted to get in contact with you, if they have extended questions or if they want to extend on some of the ideas and the sentiments that you brought up in this episode, how would they be able to get in touch, be able to get in contact with you?
I would recommend finding me on LinkedIn. I'm Susan M. Verdon on LinkedIn. It's actually linkedin.com/in/Susan M. Verdon. So that would just reach out. Feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn. I love making connections with folks and would happy to continue the conversation.
We are going to invite you back for part two because I really want to get into the second and third section of
VFE,
and it is just into my audience. Please, Susan gave you the website to go back and to get the NETP as well as other artifacts and resources focused on educational technology. But this is just an absolute honor to have you here, Susan. Again, I'm a big fan of your work. Continue to impact and influence within the ecosystem.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And on that note, onward and upward, everybody. Have a great evening.